the guest tonight, pleasure to talk to him, is retired attorney, WICN board member, and executive producer on several albums, Rich Neeland. Rich, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this stuff.
Mark, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Now, how in hell do you get to be an executive producer, and what does that mean anyway?
I know. It's a term that's not widely known. So in the music world, it's different for different entertainment aspects, but in the music world, the executive producer is similar to the CEO of a company. They make they make a lot of the business decisions, right? They may arrange financing, and they make a lot of the decisions. Where the producer, which most people know, they're really focused on the music itself. You know, what should be in that song, how it should be arranged, how it should sound. So the difference is really one is the business aspect and the other is actually the music aspect.
So let me get this straight. So you're, you know, they do a studio recording. You're sitting there listening to it and you're making suggestions. No, we need to do this here and this here.
Well, that would be the producer. And as executive producer, I'm always there. And
oh,
I'll
wow.
give my opinions.
Okay, you're used to this, Rich. I'm still in awe of the fact that you got a chance to do this, and I know somebody who does this.
Oh, well, no, it's great. I mean, it's a great thing to do. I love it.
You're preaching to the converted. Now, let's talk about these two albums, okay? The first one, is the name of the group Dyer, Goodwin, Chicor?
That's correct. Yeah, those are the three guys that put this album, and the album's called Trilby Kings, but it's under Dyer, Goodwin, Chicor. And those guys have been together for decades, really.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, long time, you know.
First of all, you have to talk about what a trilby is.
It's a hat. Yeah, it's a British hat, similar to the type of hat that, actually, it is the type of hat that Michael Jackson wore on all his videos and flipped it and so forth. And, you know,
and Leonard Cohen, and you mentioned Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen, yep, absolutely. He wore a trilby as well. And it has a little British touch to it. Derek Dyer was from Britain initially, from England. So we just wanted to put a little spin of it in there, and that's what we did.
The amazing thing is the long musical history of each one of these people. People of a certain age who aren't old enough to really appreciate it. I mean, it's amazing. Like Derek Dyer, who plays sax, congas, and backing vocals. I mean, he's toured with Tina Turner. He's toured with Joe Cocker.
That's the incredible thing about these particular musicians. They are real career musicians, unlike, you know, those who play on the weekends or what have you. These guys have been out on world tours or on the biggest albums that have ever sold. You know, Tina Turner, Joe Cocker, Robert Palmer, you could just keep going on and on. So it's just really great to work with these guys.
Well, let's just mention each of them by name. Cliff Goodwin. Guitars and backing vocals. Okay, again, another person who's New City Rockers. He's done John Mayall, James Cotton, Etta James, Steve Miller, Matt Guitar Murphy, of course, and Eric Clapton.
Yeah, he did something with Eric Clapton along the way.
And then Mitch Chicor was a name that people should be familiar with. And he toured with Joe Cocker, too. Now, there's also a common element here. Several of these people were in the American Standard Band.
Yeah, that's right.
Including the person I'm talking to.
Yeah, well, I was the sound engineer. The real guy.
Okay, now, what I know about you, Rich, is, okay, you had a law career.
Yeah, I spent 20-plus years as a chief counsel for a big semiconductor company. So I took some break from music, essentially.
Okay, we're going to back the whole thing up to the beginning.
Okay.
So when did you first start getting involved in that sort of end of the music? Did you play yourself?
Well, I did play, but I really grew up, it hit me like everyone else, the Beatles, right, when they played Ed Sullivan. So that struck me. And then my brother Michael started a band, and he played drums. And it was Alvin and the Aardvarks with Kevin Falvey on guitar.
I knew Kevin Falvey well.
Yeah. That's where I started, because Kevin was the guy with my brother Michael. They basically were playing together. And I got real involved in my mind of what could I do in music when I was only 14 or something at that point. Something like that.
Now, what year are we talking about here?
Alvin and the Aardvarks was probably 66,
okay.
67.
Yep.
And right after the Beatles, right, there were a million bands right after the Beatles came out. There were none before and then millions after. But, yeah, I was just watching Kevin. I'd sit on the basement steps and watch Kevin and my brother and their band play, and that just kept going. And eventually Kevin got with American Standard, or what was version one of American Standard.
Right.
Actually, it was a GB band to start.
That's right.
General Business. And Kevin then hooked up with Clifford and George Evans, Jimmy Evans, John Whitty, to start what I'm calling, what you know is the real American Standard.
That's right. That's exactly
1.1. Right. But then even that band went off, and that's where Joe Cocker picked up those guys like Clifford and Kevin and others and started touring with them.
You know, people don't realize how big American Standard was.
Yeah.
They were huge. Yeah.
They were huge. They were really huge. But you're right. I mean, our generation, as you say, Mark, would know. But you get back too far, of course, they're not going to know. But once you mention that, that's where Joe Cocker came in basically. And actually, they got Derek Dyer in to Tina Turner, because he came over from Bermuda to be with American Standard and eventually went on with Tina Turner. But
how would you describe for the people who have never heard American Standard, their sound? How would you describe their sound?
Yeah, it was. I thought it was progressive at the time.
Yep.
I'd say it had a little bit of Chicago in it, because they had a trumpet and they had a sax with Tommy Herbert and people like that. So kind of a little bit of American Standard was Chicago, I think.
Okay.
It's hard to really put it into a label, because it was kind of different, but it was very good for their time, I'll tell you that.
So you. Talk to me about you and American Standard.
So Kevin, basically, I went to see them play one time, and I said to them, they didn't have a sound guy. They just were doing
God.
Sound on the side. Yeah, they were doing sound on the, you know, set it up and hope it works.
Yeah. And then somebody runs back when things aren't working right.
Yeah. Oh, there's a feeding back. Somebody go get it, you know. Yeah, exactly. So Kevin said, hey, you want to, and I told him I was doing sound. I like doing sound. So he said, well, you can try it out. So I started working doing sound for them. And
how old now? Are you in college at this point, or in high school, or out of college, or what?
School. I wasn't even going to law school at that point. I was in tech school. And then I was doing electronic things. And because I went off as an engineer for a while.
Wow.
Before law school. And so I basically just got into it just because I know some technical things, so I could fix things on stage, you know, things that went bad.
By the way, everybody listening, that's what's going to be a fun job. Don't that's the thing. Learn the tech stuff, and you're going to be wanted in a lot of places.
You got that right, Mark. There's no question about
that. So how did you get detoured to law?
Well, after I went to Clark, so I went to two-year tech school, and then I went to Clark to get my bachelor's, and then I went into marketing.
Can I ask you what years you were at Clark? Because I was at Clark, too.
I graduated, I started in 74, I think.
I was still hanging around the campus, but I was out.
Oh, you were?
I was still hanging out in the student union, yeah.
Okay, well, that was a good place to hang out, I guess.
It was. It definitely was.
Yeah.
And I saw some of the best bands in my life at Clark University.
Oh yeah, Hendrix was there, and come on, that's.
I know. And you saw them in Atwood Hall too, which I thought was hilarious. You know, we thought that was a big venue at that time.
compared to the arenas today.
I know, right? The arena thing blew my mind.
I know, pretty small.
So you,
I like Clark.
I love Clark, but it was amazing. I was there from the late '60s into the early '70s.
Yeah,
It just seemed like everything we took for granted as far as music, you know, of course I'm going to see Janis Joplin at Atwood Hall.
Well, yeah, of course.
of course.
It was a big deal, you know. And I think, I promoted Jose Feliciano there, and I think it was only maybe 400 or 500 seats.
That's right.
Wasn't that big.
It's not that big at all.
No.
It did have a balcony. It had like a little balcony.
Exactly. That's right. It had a balcony. That's exactly right. Amazing stuff back then.
So you decided, what did you just think, I got to do a serious job and I'll do the law?
Yeah, so when I was, I can remember the day I was sitting in my office, a cubicle kind of thing at the company, and I'm thinking, and I'm in marketing engineering at the time, and I said, you know, I got to do something else, because when I hit later 50s and then to my 60s, I don't really want to be doing this.
I totally understand. I totally get this, Rich.
Yeah, I said, let me do something else. So I said, well, let me try law school. And then when I graduated, they gave me a job at this company, and I just, you know, went up to the top part of the law department by the time I retired. So it's just really a matter of, yeah, you got to get a job that's going to make some money. You got a family now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's really what happened there.
But how did you get back into the music scene?
Okay. So, you know, it was interesting because when I was going to retire, I said, okay, well, what am I going to do? And then I said, well, what was the happiest point of your life other than your family, which is golden to me?
Yep.
But what would be the next important thing? I said, well, I was most happiest when I was doing music and when I was playing with these guys. And then I had a small band of my own as well for a while. But I said,
I'm not going to let you get away with anything. What was that band called, that small band that
It was a Beatles cover band called Not the Beatles. And we didn't do the lookalike thing. Actually the second cover band behind Beatlemania ever. And then a million cover bands came after.
Oh, yeah. But a lot of that was like dress up.
Yeah, we didn't do any of that.
So I'm interested in all the details of this. So what songs did you cover?
We covered mostly the early songs, but we did Sgt. Pepper tunes,
okay,
which are a little difficult to do. But the guitar player, Larry Vigneault, tremendous guitar player, so he could cut all those things, all those leads really well. And we made it happen. The drummer was Bob Winston, and bass was Chris Hughes. So we had a good core of Beatle fanatics, and you know we played Worcester Tech and a lot of. Holy Cross was a big place for us to play. And
well, you know, the thing about the early catalog of the Beatles is it's just basically good rock music.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and everybody knows the songs whether you think you do or not. They're all there in your head.
They're in your head, and, you know, we obviously couldn't do, you know, the more orchestrated stuff.
Yeah.
But we did a lot of the early
stuff. So you didn't cover A Day in the Life?
No, we didn't cover that one. And it was requested a lot, too.
People lighting matches, Day in a Life.
Well, that, you know, when we were at Worcester Tech, that was a huge concert and in the gym there. And some guy in the back just kept yelling that out, A Day in the Life. And we're sitting there, geez, we don't know the damn song, you know. We know it, but we don't know how to play it.
He just wanted to hear that piano note at the end that lasted for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, then your set's over. You can get off the stage.
So you go from that, and you decide you're going to get back into the more engineering part of it?
Yeah, so basically after I got out of, Not the Beatles, I then went to the Centrum. And I was event coordinator at the Centrum when it first opened up. So that was there for maybe 2 to 3 years, I think.
Best musical act you saw at the Centrum?
Oh, my God. I liked someone like Jethro Tull, I thought was great.
Okay.
Prince was there. But, you know, as far as the show, you know, when you're event coordinator, you don't get to see much of the show.
Yeah, you're right.
It's so busy, right? But there were some great acts. They're not doing as much there anymore, but when they opened, it was 4 or 5 concerts a week.
I got to see Iggy Pop and the Pretenders.
Okay. That must have been after me. What year was that?
I can't even remember. All I know is it was a damn good show.
Yeah.
And I think Iggy Pop opened for the Pretenders, and I thought that was wild.
Yeah, that's sort of curious, actually.
But that used to be a great place to see rock acts like that. That was like the biggest I was. I'm not a big person for the big, you know, stadium stuff. No. I get spoiled at Clark. And so there's no way I'm going to go to these stadiums and go to – I want a looser set for a place to be.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. You know, and I think the last one I went to was at the Centrum before it was the DCU Center, and I think it was Paul McCartney, actually.
Oh.
That was like way back into the 90s somewhere.
So is that the first time you saw one of the Beatles?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I played – you know, we almost had one come to a show here in Worcester because when we had the Not the Beatles thing going, we played with Beatlemania someplace in Worcester. and it's one of the shopping malls or something. And they all showed up, and they came on stage with us. So we played a bunch of Beatles songs together, which was kind of cool.
Well, it is cool.
And Beatlemania was that New York, you know, the New York Broadway guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Really started it. So that was fun. But I heard that one of the Beatles may be coming around for some reason.
Oh, no.
Never happened. But
so did you see McCartney play with Wings?
No, I did not.
So it was post Wings. Yeah.
Yeah, it was post Wings. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you're getting more of the technical business end of the rock business.
Exactly. At the Centrum, I did get good exposure to a lot of that. And then, you know, just being in, even as a small local or New England band, you know, you learn the trade a little bit.
Yeah. Yep.
Dealing with club owners and college people and all that. And, you know.
People don't realize what a skill that is.
It is, because you're dealing with a lot of different people.
Who have a lot of different attitudes.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. But that's really what happened. But to get to this album, this first album, the Trilby King album, is what happened is in the COVID thing, right? So
yeah.
In 2020, the summer, I met with Cliff Goodwin, and I said, Cliff, I knew just how bad things were for musicians, right? And you knew that, Mark,
because yeah.
we talked about Kayla Farnham not too long ago.
Yep. Yep.
And her album, she's doing great. But I'd been to Abbey Road with Kayla, and I loved it. And so I said to Cliff, hey, look, why don't we go and do your second album at Abbey Road Studios? Of course, he looked at me as if I was crazy.
Well, then, I mean, you're talking about Legendary Studios.
Yeah, exactly. And Cliff and the guys, they're all huge Beatles fans, just like me. So once he realized I was serious, he called up these guys, Derek and Mitch and Marty Riches and David Genandez or Genandez.
Yep.
And they said, let's bring these guys over. And,
okay, now you're going to walk me through this, okay, Rich?
Oh, okay.
What was it like to first step inside Abbey Road Studios? Because to me, I would just be like in awe.
Well, it is. So I was telling the guys, when I was there with Kayla, we didn't record there. We were there just to master her album. But I went into Studio 2, which is where they really did 90% of their work over there. And I told the guys, when I went in there with Kayla, I was 10 feet off the floor.
Yeah.
Just because the feeling in there is
right, the vibes.
Culture. Oh, it's incredible. They haven't changed it.
Oh, man.
The vibe is just, you're just saying, wow, this is where it all changed. You know,
Jeez.
Styles of hair, not only music, hair, cultures, clothing, right in that room, essentially.
Wow.
So we were all, when I brought the band over, I said, you're going to feel the same thing that I did. And of course they did, because they're as big a Beatle fans as I am.
Wow.
And they were just in awe. You know, it takes a good hour. You just look around for an hour before you do anything. It's like, okay, where was the Beatles doing this record? And where did they do that record? And, you know, it all comes rushing back because you've only seen pictures of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're right there, you know.
Wow.
It was so cool. So that album, that Cliff's album, Cliff Goodwin, is going to be out probably early summer.
What's the title? Do you know?
It'd be Cliff Goodwin's Rhythm and Blues Union.
Okay.
And it kind of follows off his first album, which is out there. But it's going to be a great album. I mean, Abbey Road sounds great. Cliff's got some great songs going on this album. And it's the same guys that did the Trilby one that you just heard. The only difference is that Cliff will be doing the lead vocals. So it's just really good album. It's fun to do. That one was still working on.
Talk to me about, okay, just from a technical point of view, Rich, because this is what I want to, okay, you record the album at Abbey Road. Where is it mixed?
So we recorded it all there. We did all the basic tracks there, like drums, you know.
Yep.
You know, you do some overdubs like saxophone and guitar, but basically drums and bass and rhythm and keyboards and stuff like that. And then we came back here. We did a couple more overdubs, and we're doing some mixing right now out at a place called Spirit House Music, which is in Western Massachusetts. And so we're mixing there with some really, really good mixers. So we'll do that in mass, and then we'll get it out there in the really early summer. I'm hoping for that one.
Let me, as a person who still plays rock on the air here at WICN,
yeah. Yeah, you do, yeah.
What the challenge is always getting your stuff heard now. This is not like the old days. It's really a challenge, yeah. And everything has to be pigeonholed. You know,
yeah.
Everything has to fit. What do you think of, I mean, what's your take on that, about the challenge getting the stuff?
No, there's no question. I think, I mean, both these albums are on vinyl, which is great.
This is good. Great.
Yeah, vinyl's coming back to a pretty large degree, actually. And CDs are, you know, they're still out there, but they're getting less. Cars don't have CD players anymore. And so we decided to do something different, retro. We went to vinyl.
Does that mean that there's going to be good album art?
Yeah.
Because one of the real pleasures of albums was that you had this big space where you could put album art and then liner notes that you could actually read on the back.
That's exactly right, you know, and that's gone, because CDs don't, when you pick up a CD, it's probably there, but you don't have the same,
nah.
at least for my generation, it doesn't have the same.
Well, you can say our generation.
Our generation.
Right. that was one of the joys, listening to the record while reading the liner notes.
You're right. Yeah, you would devour the liner notes, and you would know everybody in the band.
Yeah.
You know, these days, they play the music, but you could ask people who love the songs, well, who's on there? Well, I don't know. You know, it's just completely different.
It's all overmixed for the most part, especially contemporary dance music is tremendously overmixed. And you have no idea. I mean, the number of tracks that they lay down is insane now, so that they get the right sound.
I know.
And it's funny, because when I heard the Trilby Kings, it really brought me back.
Yeah,
there was a kind of power and blam there that really brought me back to the classic days of rock.
Well, that's what these albums are doing, and especially Cliff's as well. They bring you back to songs that, and they rearranged them, right? They're not exactly the same, nor should they be. They've rearranged them and they're bringing them back. So, you know, our generation, you know, loves it. And the albums are getting great reviews and getting played. And there's some stuff that was played off the Trilby albums over in Britain. But, you know, it's different with Spotify and these kind of Pandoras out there. A lot of people say, well, why would I buy the record if I can just listen to the whole thing for nothing?
That's another big difference.
That's a problem, yeah.
Yeah, that is a problem. No, but And the other thing is, you're only on Spotify, you're only getting what you already know.
Yeah.
So you're not listening. We don't have the great radio stations that we did back then, like the BCN, where they had a wide range of stuff that they played within any hour, and then you heard stuff you wanted to buy.
That's where you got it.
Yeah.
BCN, AAF for a while. Yeah. That's where you got it. You're right.
Yep. Absolutely.
And you don't have that anymore.
So, is it on the Trilby Kings that there are three new released tunes and then five reinterpreted classics?
Yeah, exactly, Mark. So there's three songs that a friend of the band's, a guy named John Savannah, wrote. He was with a bunch of bands, including you got me on that one. Anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. But he was playing with a bunch of people for years, and he moved to Massachusetts and knew Derek, and he had written these songs. And we listened to these songs. And it's the reason the album came about, really. I listened to these songs, and Derek and I said, let's do an album with this guy singing the songs of John Savannah. So Tim Pike sang the songs, and John Savannah wrote the songs, and the band arranged them and put them out. So those three have never been heard. And the rest are, there's five covers on there as well.
Let me talk to you about Dyer, Goodwin, and Shakur.
Hmm.
Did it take a while for them to sort of gravitate and like work with each other again?
No, they really never stopped. They were playing with like all kinds of people. I mean, all along the way.
That's the thing about mature musicians. They know how to fit in right away.
No, absolutely. They have different iterations of the band, right? So they have the All Stars, which was Mohegan Sun's All Stars, and then they have another version, and so they just have sort of a consortium of artists that they put together when they want to do a gig. But those three guys, including Marty Richards on drums, I mean, he's from the Rhode Island Hall of Fame. That guy's been everywhere.
Yeah.
So they put that together, and they get David together, and they play, and it's great. So they have different iterations is really the way I explain it to people. But they've been playing for 40 years at least.
Would there ever be an American Standard reunion?
Well, without Kevin,
yeah, I know.
I doubt it. That wouldn't really work, I don't think. Certainly have Cliff, and the other guys are still with us. But, yeah, without Kevin, he was a major part of the vocal.
Yeah, he was. He was the spirit of the whole thing.
I think so. I think so. So it wouldn't have the same feel.
But you could do a tribute to Kevin reunion of the
band. You could do that.
I think that would be excellent. To just like, yeah. Maybe for one night.
You'd have to talk to Cliff about that.
Do you think he'd be up for it?
I don't know. I think Cliff is probably going to say the same thing. Without Kevin, it would be very difficult.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think it would be. And, you know, some of the other guys, I mean, Derek was an American Standard. He'd probably do it. But I don't know about some of the earlier guys, whether they're still really able to play some of those.
Now, is the Trilby Kings out now?
Yeah, so it's out. It's exclusively Joe's Albums in Worcester.
Nice.
They do the distribution for us for anybody who needs to get one or wants to get one. So, yeah, that one's out. The vinyl just I think we're releasing the vinyl this week, actually.
Great. Excellent.
Yes. And the CD's been out for a while, and it's up on YouTube. Some of the songs are up on YouTube. But I think the vinyl goes out this week.
Okay, here's a question just before we leave, and it's it's an awful one to spring on a person like you and me.
Uh-oh.
This week, what's the album that you listen to sort of the most, besides this one?
That's really tough because we're working on Cliff's album.
Okay, other than the projects that you're working on, album do you go back to?
Steely Dan. I like
FM. Man. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm a Steely Dan guy, so I'll go back to those. I just like the music. It's pretty sophisticated, and just good players. So I was listening to FM maybe earlier last week.
Yeah, I really like early Steely Dan, so Pretzel Logic and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's good stuff. You know, and they've transitioned, of course, through the years. But yeah, that's who I think I listened to last, if I can recall.
With that, we're going to have to sign up. Otherwise, Rich and I will be shooting the shit about rock for the rest of our lives. My guest tonight has been Rich Neeland. He's a retired attorney. He's a member of the WICN board. He is the executive producer for the Trilby Kings and for Cliff Goodwin's new album that's coming out. Rich, it's a pleasure always. Like I said, we could just talk forever about music.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll talk again, Mark.
I hope so. Stuff like this brings me joy. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry.
Snow in Birmingham. Thought you would be wondering where I am. Rang no number all night long. Get no comfort on the telephone. Ran out of coffee, a midnight flight. Thought that love would make everything all right. The landlord said, you move.